Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
It's a rare occasion when I can find a scientist willing to talk frankly and openly about climate change. And when I do, the enormity of what they have to say can be difficult to accept. Dr. Sanborn Scott is just one of those few. His latest book, Smelling Land, is full of reality, but still it gives a glimmer of hope for the future. He stresses hydrogen as the fuel and, yes, sees the merit in nuclear. Today's show features Dr. David Sanborn Scott at the Engineering Conference at McMaster University.
Who has a doctorate in mechanical engineering and astronomical sciences from the Northwestern University. In 1966, David joined the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Toronto and became the departmental chair in 76. He founded the University of Toronto's Institute of Hydrogen Systems. He chaired the Canadian Advisory Group on Hydrogen Opportunities. In 1989, he joined the University of Victoria, where he founded its Institute for Integrated Energy Systems, IESVIC. IESVIC is developing fuel cell systems for liquefaction and performing energy systems. He is the author of Smelling the Land. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sanborn Scott. By the way, the title that I'm going to use, as you will see, is different than in the program when it comes alive. The program says, "It's the system, stupid. Reflections on services, currencies, hydricity, nuclear, and renewables." And hydricity is my word for hydrogen and electricity, two energy currencies. I start by reminding us of what Einstein once said. The many good things he said. A problem cannot be solved from the same consciousness that created it. Okay, now if I stand on Einstein's shoulders, I can say opportunities cannot be won except from an entirely new consciousness that illuminated them. So now what's the problem? Well, John Boyd just said engineers sit in their corner and do things that are important, but they're narrow. I have greater hopes for engineers than that, but that is the truth for many. So the question is, what is the problem? Is it, in other words, minimizing the heat loss from a cryogenic tank? I would suggest that there are two problems that face us. Only one is critically important, and it's called climate disruption, climate volatility, I would say climate catastrophe. The second problem is not that we're running out of oil, but that there's a vast, massive maldistribution around the world. And to say it simply, countries that have oil don't need as much. The countries that need oil don't have enough. And those, I think, are the secondary problems to climate. So now, what is this conviction that created the problem? Well, I might start by saying it is not the oil companies, and it is not OPEC, and it is not the automobile manufacturers. It may just a little be greed, but on the other hand, I think its root overwhelmingly is the absence of a deep, holistic appreciation of how our energy system works. Now that will offend you because you think you're engineers and you think you know how it works. But I would suggest that many of us don't really think how the system works. First, its job is not to deliver energy. Its job is to deliver energy services. Second, the problem is not energy sources, or are not energy sources. The problem is rooted in the critical yet invisible role of what I call energy currencies. So what are the energy currencies? They're the middle link in a five-link chain, which, and we can make this architecture any way we like, I make it as a five-link chain, which, again, to quote Einstein, I've kept as simple as possible, but in my mind, not simpler. Okay, there's this five-link chain as I see it. I hope you can read it. It starts on the left with services. In other words, that's what drives the system, the services that we need. As engineers, it took me 8 years to wake up to this. I kept thinking as an engineer, you make energy and then it goes down the system the other way. But it's driven because people want services, and to deliver those services, we need service technologies. I'll give you some examples. And these are just examples, but note we've got an energy sector highlighted there, which are currencies, harvesting technologies, and sources. Now, I'm going to offend folks here, but unfortunately, this is what the Globe and Mail calls the energy sector. That's what we think is the energy sector. But you can't understand any system and how it really works if you truncate a couple of really critical links. And they are the service technologies, and in particular the services. Note what the services are. It isn't just making steel, although that's important, and it isn't just transportation. It's food preparation, illumination, healthcare, and all those things. Next time you go into the hospital, you know that engineers are delivering 90% of the services. Okay? And by the way, they're the services that worked. They're called hip replacements and shoulder replacements and that sort of thing. Let me carry on. On the right-hand side, the sources, you have coal, sunlight, crude oil, on and on and on, wind, and tides. They're the services, they're the sources that nature has always provided, and they do not change. We run out of them locally, but they're consistent. And the services that people want are pretty much evolutions of Maslow's desires. Here is how, and I want to emphasize, is currencies. And currencies really profoundly shape the system, but you can see what it is. It's how we delivered land transportation. So here's land transportation down here. Here are the sources that we harvested. Here's the currency. This one was the source of sunlight, agriculture, hay, horse, transportation. Okay, then the next one is still sunlight, forestry, wood, steam locomotive, transportation. And you can read them as you go down. In other words, it's down here you go to coal fields. Then you get to the consciousness that we have today, which is crude oil, oil refinery, gasoline, internal combustion engines, and the service. Now note something here which has already happened with electricity. Once you get to the currency of hydrogen, as we have already got to the currency of electricity, then you have a plethora of sources. Natural gas, sunlight, wind, uranium, and so on. It's a big funnel that will allow you to make hydrogen wherever you want, or wherever those sources are available, just as we do with electricity today. So now the question is, why hydrogen? Compared to all those other things that people love to talk about. Well, hydrogen, as you will see from my view, is absolutely the end state that we must get to. It's not an option, folks. Hydricity is going to be the way we have to run the world, and I'll leave you with some ideas on why. The question, then, is not what the end state should be. The question is how we get there. And here's a closed cycle, which, you know, keeping it as simple as possible, you can't keep things simpler than this equation. And this equation has a whole lot of profound things in it. One, it goes both ways. From left to right, which is how we make hydrogen, and it can go from left to right, left, right to left, which is how we use it. But note how profound this is with the information that's in it. It's a total renewable currency. Renewable sources really have their difficulties in some cases, but renewable currencies do not. The other one is called electricity. And by the way, when you look at this, a lot of people have said to me, well, I guess the wonderful thing about hydrogen is that there's so much water in the world, I can't imagine running out of water to get the hydrogen. Well, that's like saying the nice thing about electricity is there's so many electrons in the world that I can't imagine running out of electricity. So what we do with electricity, of course, is we split charges, and then we bring them back to a charge neutrality when we use it. We do it quickly, typically under a second. And with hydrogen, we split the water, and it comes back to be water, so it's a totally complete recyclable surface. Now, the climate imperative, in my view, the climate imperative is not just to reduce by little bits CO2, is to drive it to zero. And in order to drive to zero, we have to eliminate CO2 emissions. And that requires both non-carbon sources. I didn't say non-fossil. I said non-carbon. To pick up again what the opening comment was, biofuels are non-fossil, but they're a disaster. Okay, so non-carbon are the winds and the sunlights and the wind and the nuclears and so on. But we've got them, and we need non-carbon currencies to get that energy that we've harvested from non-carbon sources into these service technologies. There are many non-carbon sources available, and I've written them down. In contrast, there are only two non-carbon currencies that can together provide all the services that civilization uses today or could conceivably want in the future, and they are electricity and hydrogen. Now the question is, can anything better come along? And this started from a student in the back of the class. You know, students said, these ones aren't that way. They're sitting there in the back of the class with their baseball caps on backwards and wanted me to critique. And most, in fact, all have bought into this. Some have shaped careers because of these ideas. And they said, you mean until something better comes along? And that caused me pause. Because I didn't, but I hadn't got my arguments tight. Okay, so I went home and thought about it. And I realized that what that student was thinking about are technologies. We're all used to new technologies coming along. Knockout, better computers. In fact, few of us even have desktops anymore. We have laptops. But these are currencies, folks. They're not technologies. They're not a better sort. Okay? And what we need to develop a full range of services is both an electronic currency and a protonic. That means chemical. I'm just using the word proton as it's meaning. Well, we've got them here, and I've identified what they are. If you go to the protonic currencies, you have to remember that we're restricted to that thing, which is a mechanical engineer. I looked at it but didn't remember well. It's called a periodic table. Okay? If it isn't in the periodic table, we can't use it. And it doesn't matter about some bright physicist dreaming up some new one at the top end of the scale. You have to then take that periodic table and cut it back to those things that are plentiful in the environment. And what are they? They're nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon, except that we know that carbon is traced in the environment and we can't put more in. So you're really down to these chemicals, nitrogen, hydrogen, and oxygen. I apologize. It took me 10 years to get to this, and I'm asking you to get to it in, 2 minutes. But I want you to go away from this talk and think about it. Is there some other way to do it? So it must be plentiful in the environment, so you're down to ammonia and hydrogen. And we can use ammonia, but why use it? It's prickly stuff. It's a valuable commodity for fertilizers. But other than that, you're into hydrogen, especially because of weight. Sorry, take-home message. I have been persuaded, and I have asked audience after audience, tell me another way that we could run the world without emitting a drop of CO2 other than by using the two currencies, hydrogen and electricity, when they're manufactured by non-carbon sources. And no one has given me an answer. They always suck me down into the weeds, like it'll cost too much, or, we haven't got enough platinum for fuel cells, or those sorts of things. But all of those things are answerable. Please take away, if there's a single takeaway message, it's that the end state of a non-carbon world, non-carbon in the atmosphere world, or emitted by humankind, should be hydrogen and electricity manufactured by non-carbon sources. And that's what I call hydricity. So note that I'm not focusing on the sources, which people are always talking about. I'm talking about the currencies. And here are synergies. This is the Jack Sprat could eat no fat. His wife could eat no meat. And so twixt them both, they licked the platter clean. Okay, so there's wonderful things between hydrogen and electricity and their compatibility. Hydrogen can be stored in enormous quantities, and that's the major barrier with electricity these days. You cannot do that. Electricity moves material, moves energy without moving material. Hydrogen cannot. That may seem a minor one, but in other longer talks, I point out that all environmental damage comes one way or another from the intrusion of material on nature's fluxes and equilibria. Okay, so in other words, it's just safer if you move less material. Hydrogen is a chemical material feedstock. It can make plastics and wonderful sailboats, but electricity cannot. Electricity can process and store information. Hydrogen cannot. Hydrogen wins in the long haul for energy transport on planet Earth, and I'm speaking through pipelines. In other words, it's just cheaper and more effective and has resilience, which I'll speak to you about. But there are similarities, and you can read them. Both hydrogen electricity can be harvested. I say harvested from any energy source. It appalls me that so many engineers say we're producing energy. When you learned on your mother's knee that energy is conserved, we harvest it from nature, and obviously we intrude in nature's flows, like Niagara Falls, close by. I mean, that energy was all there, and it was all chewed up on rocks set at the bottom of the falls, and so we intruded it with turbines and penstocks, and on the way to nature's equilibrium, we took some of that harvested electricity, or energy, made it into electricity, shipped it into Trauma and Buffalo, lit some lights, and pulled some speed cars. And here's the big one. Hydrogen and electricity can be interchangeably converted. That can't happen today. The oil embargo, which we called an energy crisis, which led us off into a lot of strange things, it was an energy crisis, wouldn't have happened if we could have used Ontario's nuclear power to make gasoline. But you can't. You can make electricity out of gasoline, and we do it every day on our car, but not the other way around. And both hydrogen and electricity, of course, are renewable. So let me say some things about a hydrogen age. Not many, unfortunately, but here's one thing. I drew this slide up for nuclear, really, and I've changed it to say nuclear and non-carbon services. In other words, services that are provided by nuclear or non-carbon. Today, it's only electricity. And you can see that the bucket that holds electricity, things like computer, etc., is comparatively small compared to the bucket that can be fed by hydrogen, which is all materials and commodities and making steel, if you still have a steel plant, and flying airplanes and the rest of it. I'm going to, people you like this word segue, I'm going to talk about liquid hydrogen airplanes just because it's characteristic of some hydricity technologies or hydrogen technologies. And for those who know about exergy, and Mark Rosen was here, he's making sure that people understand the difference between exergy and energy. You know, even grunt mechanical engineers, old ones like me, we had availability. Remember, steam had so much availability in it, and the rest of it was just wasted. Well, it turns out that we're a lot better off to use exergy. By the way, I'll do another segue here. Remember that we carry exergy, that is the ability to do work in two forms. One is chemical and one is thermomechanical. And if you go back to the development of civilization, James Watt's steam engine, steam is all thermomechanical. It's all in pressure and temperature. There's no chemical exergy or ability to do work in water. Today we're largely to currencies which are pure chemical exergy, like gasoline. Okay? There's no thermomechanical exergy in gasoline in your tank. But in the future, first of all, when we go to LNG, that is liquefied natural gas, and in the end, liquefied hydrogen, note that the thermomechanical exergy is 11%. Chemical exergy is 89%. When you have two exergy commodities in one currency, there are a lot of ways that you can do wonderful things. Cryogenic cooling, this is all worked out by Lockheed. And you'll see, will reduce. What they do is they take the cryogen on the way to the engine, and they can cool the wings and about a third of the fuselage and the engine nacelles, etc., and they reduce the drag. And they reduce the drag by delaying separation. And that means that the fuel reduction at altitude is down by 30%. The overall cost, according to the analysis of Lockheed, to develop these designs, is down by 20%. So you see, you get much more bang per buck from the coal than you do from the chemistry. Okay, and that'll be true of a lot of synergies that would go on in life. Payload is mad. By the way, hydrogen weighs a third of what kerosene does, approximately, not quite that. And so the range really goes up. It can be three times as long in the air, okay, with the same weight, and in fact, because of all the other fishes, the range goes up by more than a factor of three, so search and rescue really goes up. Profits go up. No thermal rating. Oh, there's something on safety. I put that in. Had the two aircraft that hit the Twin Towers had been liquid hydrogen fuel, a lot of people would have been killed and it would have been a disaster, but the towers almost certainly would not have come down, would not have come down. Okay, because the reason the towers came down is the airplanes hit the towers. That kerosene or jetty coursed its way down through the steel backbone, burning, softening it, losing structural integrity, and whack, down they came. It was a time after that they came down. And note that the second tower to be hit, which was lower, was the first tower down, because there was a greater sledging going on top. Okay, so as you soften this, down they came. If it had been hydrogen, first of all, the hydrogen has to vaporize to catch fire. Okay? Then it would have been up and away. I mean, it's the lightest element in the universe. It just would have been up there. Carry on. What can we do today? Well, I'm going to say this. It's really tough for individuals to do much, except understand where we have to go, and talk about it in cocktail parties and these sorts of things, and finally get a public awareness. There's an extraordinary absence of public awareness. We're thinking that if we put in efficiency light bulbs, that will do it. Some jurisdictions have legislated. Quebec puts in high-efficiency light bulbs, and guess what? The greenhouse gas emissions go up. Why? Because it's rather cold in Quebec. And if you turn off your incandescent lights, which are heating the house, you have to turn on the boilers to keep the house warm. And Quebec essentially uses no fossil fuel. Okay, but it's this stupid, simple thing. Forget the system. That's why I say it's the system, stupid, which allows this legislation to come in and everybody feels sanctimonious about it, good, and goes away, except the problem gets worse. So I would plead with you to think and understand and think systemically. Think of those next two chains and think that our problem is CO2. This comes from Clem Bowen. Some of you will know Clem Bowen. Clem called me and talked to me about an energy, Trans-Canada energy, or electric grid, and we should have one in. Not, and lots of reasons why we do not, and we should go that way. And I said to Clem, well, you know, when they built the bridge across the Don Valley Parkway, correction, across the Don Valley, some bright engineers, to go to the history of engineering, said, you know, someday Toronto will need a subway. And if they want a subway, they're going to have to get it across the Don Valley. And why don't we build that bridge with a lower deck that can carry the subway? And every time we take that subway now across that lower deck, think about those engineers that were anticipating the future. And what I said to Clem was, think that way for what we've got to do with hydrogen when it comes out. And when you get the right-of-way for this network for electricity, make sure the right-of-way has room for pipelines. And so we began, Clem and I, to talk about it as a hydricity corridor rather than a net, okay, or grid. Clem is not willing to call it hydricity. He thinks people will think we're too crazy and flaky on that. But we'll call it then a corridor, at least, and in the end it will be hydrogen electricity. Now, these are Clem's ideas. He said, then we'll have a system which breathes out and breathes in. And all the problems that I hear about building new nuclear, which is what are you going to do with the power when your peak load, they vanish, because now you can stuff that into hydrogen. And who needs Alberta? Okay, they really need it at least for the next month of generations. We can't shut that down. And you need it for upgrading the oils, and you need it for a bunch of other things. And you need hydrogen for making ammonia, and so on and so on. So this idea, I'm not going into all the details, but okay, it's not original to me. It's original now thinking with Clem Bowman and me, that we have a corridor which massively uses electricity and then gets into sea. I've got, removes the intermittency barrier for whimsical. Whimsicals are my word for most renewables, not all. Hydraulic isn't whimsical, but a windmill sure is, and sunlight sure is, and that's the problem. The capital cost of a windmill is not just the capital cost of the windmill, which is much higher than conventional electricity production. It's the capital cost of the spinning reserve that you have back there when the windmill quits. Okay? So I think that National and Continental, we could be building these, I'll call them corridors, and that would be really, it would move things along. Now, the next question is, this is, I'm using the German word, Holger can criticize me, national, that is. I want you to think of liquid hydrogen at all major airports, because I've already told you about the sweet things about airplanes. aircraft builders couldn't afford to be left behind. What's stopping it now is the infrastructure. Lockheed has those designs ready to go, so they're going. I've said a thing. But I want to emphasize the stratospheric CO2. The lifetime or residence time, to use our engineering term, of CO2 in the stratosphere is in and around 300 to 400 years. Okay? I am told by folks like Dan Minnelli that the residence time of spent fuel from a CANDU reactor is 500 to 600 years until it gets back to what it was like in the ground. It's toxicity, it's radiotoxicity. The lifetime toxicity of CO2 in the upper atmosphere is on the same order of magnitude of the lifetime toxicity of spent fuel from CANDU reactors, which isn't spent anyway. It's just partially used, and we shouldn't be burying it. We should be, storing it and reprocessing it. So you see, we've gained all these wonderful things from this. I got that up just to say a few closing comments, which will stay within 10 minutes. And to do this, I want to paint you a picture of the high-risk future. You know, radio and TV have always often said, paint me a picture of what the future, and I often have not been ready, so I'm going to say some things which will shock you again. These are white level comments. The first is the continental energy corridors. Today, they are electricity dominated. In the future, they'll first move to hydricity dominated, that'll electricity and hydrogen, and then in the end, it'll be hydrogen. And this, even with the hydricity corridors, will provide a great robustness. Things of blackouts will be gone. In other words, the reason for that, of course, is hydrogen pipeline is a sponge. It takes something out and it'll take the whole system out. It will be clean transportation, and I mentioned especially here. Fossil sources, it's always interesting what's going to happen when the old source of something isn't needed anymore for the future. I'm talking about a deep future now. Fossil sources will still be needed, of course, for materials. That will be an investive rather than a consumptive use of fossil sources. And now I'll say something which might put you off, but I'll still say it. The clever guys that are biologists and know how to make crab out of fish will surely know how to make sausages and meat and wonderful salmon out of oil. Okay, so that will take pressures off agriculture, and away we go. We'll get zero calls from oil spills from tankers and the rest of it. And then there'll be a plethora of unimaginables. Now, what I mean by unimaginables is when electricity came in, and we just talked about it, what did it do? It provided services that we knew we needed, like illumination and pulling streetcars. And then other generations of bright engineers and scientists dreamed up microelectronic chips and the like of it. And then along came all those things like GPS, etc., which were truly unimaginable at the turn of the last century. Now we have fuel cells. And one of the characteristics of fuel cells is it mimics microelectronic chips in this way. It's infinitely miniaturized. So when we realize we can infinitely miniaturize fuel cells, there'll be a plethora of wonderful opportunities that come along. Now, let me just say this. That's painting a picture with hydrogen.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News. This is 93.3 CFMU FM.
What about a picture without it? And this probably will annoy you again. I think that IPCC underestimates the problems. We've talked today about some countries putting up dikes. It's important to know that we could be over a metastable limit and it will not stop these oceans coming up. You might want to know that I just sold my home, which some of you visited, which is about 5 meters above the Pacific, and I'm now 150 meters above the Pacific. Okay? Not because I think it's going to get me, but I think within 20 years or so, people will realize that oceanfront property is really not worth very much, and that's the only legacy that I have to leave for my kids. We will have climate volatility with a vengeance. 9 out of 10 world's largest cities are on the oceans. Think about that. We will lose those 9 out of 10 cities which are on oceans. Okay? We will lose probably 75% or more of our economic infrastructure. So how are we going to claw back? How are future generations going to claw back? We're going to have pandemic diseases. Think about the nonsense that we're also uptight about the swine flu today, right? I mean, we ain't seen nothing yet. And then there's going to be those vicious wars for survival. We have often gone to war, either for religious reasons or otherwise. So the choice is this. It is not possible to stay in today's world. We have to move to a clean, strong, rich, high-risky world, or we go to an ages which a couple of generations, I think, and this is my opinion, will be worse probably than the Dark Ages. I mean, it's actually catastrophic, which I think what will come. But here's the problem. Leonardo da Vinci, to quote somebody else, said, begin with the end in mind, people will always find a way to get there. And today we are tweaking today's consciousness with efficient light bulbs and that sort of stuff. We're denying the problem. People say we can make electricity carbon free, and we sure can. How does that get to fly an airplane? Okay, so we need the hydrogen to fly the airplane and down to ships and the rest of it. So the issue, in my judgment, is not where we end up, but what are the right paths to get there? And no one has this end in mind, and I'd be happy to be proven wrong. At my age, you don't like to be shrill, but I have to be very, very clear on what I think. Now, I'm hoping this keeps going. So there's my conclusion. The need is critical, the solution is straightforward. At least it's straightforward. People say it isn't straightforward at all. Well, when they're saying it's not straightforward, they're meaning how to get there isn't straightforward. But it is straightforward, and we've done it. How do you think we flew to the moon? That was a hydrogen system. We made the hydrogen, we stored it, we ran it in fuel cells with the propellant and all that. How do we think we fly the shuttles today? It's all hydrogen. So the technologies are there. Okay, it's a matter of bringing them down to Earth and using them more efficiently. The dithering is terrifying, and the clock is running, and I've made it under 10 minutes. Thank you.
We had a chance to talk to Dr. Scott in more detail after the conference. I do think that the United States, with the national corridor, the internal corridor, if you've been following NAFTA, if you've been following the NAU, which I have been watching that corridor, and independents get it because they're there with an independent camera just on the ground shooting it and throwing it up on YouTube. And that's what I love about the independent media. You know, there's no slant if they just put a camera on a town hall where people in Texas are saying, all of a sudden, I'm losing my property. Why? So we can have this 8-football-field-wide corridor go up the middle of North America. So one has to think, and I have often thought this, they know what's going to happen with the coastlines. They know that there's going to be flooding. Why else would there be a rush for this major corridor to go up the middle of North America and come out in 4 places in Canada? And when you cross that over and look at the maps of the pipelines, you cross it over and look at the maps of water that they're fighting over and overlay some of the maps we even saw today about carbon capture. They're all in the same latitudes and longitudes. I think they know there's going to be flooding, they being the Canadian United States government, especially the American government.
I wish I agreed with you, but I don't.
Okay.
I think that they remain totally ignorant. Look at the comments that were made today. It might go up by a foot or so, they're saying. Well, it's important to know what the world has done. The world has melted all the landlocked ice. Ice floating doesn't change the levels of the ocean, but the landlocked ice, which is Greenland and Antarctica, sure does.
Mm-hmm.
The levels of the oceans of the world go up by about 270 feet.
270 feet.
Now, I am now in beautiful BC. I used to live in Ontario. I used to sail in Ontario. The chart datum of Lake Ontario is 273 feet. So if you look to a future like that, you haven't raised the oceans by a foot or so. You've taken out Montreal, and Toronto is beaches with salt water. Now, that's in a deep future, but let me go to what will likely happen within the next 20 to 25 years. You don't have to melt that ice. You just fission it. Do you know what I mean? And we're fissioning it now, particularly in Antarctica on the Ross Ice Shelf. And that ice is sitting on rock, and that rock, between the rock and the ice, is lubricated by clay and water, and we're melting water, and it's running down through the fissures, and the lubrication is getting better, and bits are dropping off. Now, the point is that people say that we could break off chunks which would raise the levels of the oceans almost instantaneously, by 5 to 25 meters. Now, that's scary.
That is frightening.
That is just nonsense. Now, you know the Maldives. At least they have some wisdom in the world. Guess where it is? In the Maldives. The president of the Maldives is using a number of their tourist daughters to buy land so they'll have places to move to.
Mm-hmm.
But they say it won't be home. But they'll still have places to move through in Australia or something.
And I know people that have already moved to New Zealand.
Well, New Zealand if you go high. I mean, as you know, I said this morning, I've sold my house on the ocean to go up above the ocean now. Because I think that within 20 years, people will realize that oceanfront property is really not. But Maggie, no one can get their heads around that. Can you get your head around Bangladesh vanishing? And then what do you do with the boat people? What we should be doing now with the climate and studies like this, like Bali, is not arguing about who should have carbon taxes. We should start before it happens to say, who's going to accept these people and accept them well? Or some of you don't want to accept them at all. You'll use your armies to keep them out. Do you know what I mean? We're going into tragedies.
Well, I have heard, even at our local Hamilton Council meetings, we're talking about population influx and climate refugees.
There will be those. There'll be wars, because that'll trigger wars. So what appalls me is when people say it's global warming. And warming is just the trigger. All the rest of the oceans. We were just talking about oceans. I mean, the CO2 that is building up is being absorbed in the ocean. And we used to do this. My dad had a CO2 capsule that he put in a bottle and he went, psst, to do what? To make soda water. Well, that's carbonic acid. Okay, carbonic acid is killing the ocean. The acid levels of the oceans are going up. It's not just getting warmer. We really are severely damaging our planet.
I've heard beyond damage of the coral reefs, I've heard fish being cooked in certain areas of the ocean.
I'm not sure about that, but I suppose that's true. But in other words, you can't acidify all the oceans of the world without really changing the life in the oceans, and that's where we get most of our protein.
And that's where we get our climate from, too.
Absolutely.
People don't understand it. The climate. When I say to some people, you know, I want to get into checking the climate over something, they think, well, it's what you watch on TV. It's the winds that have always come to the same jet patterns. And I'm thinking, no, it isn't. It's so much bigger than that. When you warm the waters, you increase airflow.
And you increase hurricanes.
Right.
See, what we're talking about is the problem. A lot of people talk about the problem. What I should do with a little bit of time is at least tell you why there is potentially a solution. And the solution, no one's talking about solutions. They're talking about tiddly little things.
Yeah.
You see, we have to realize that the way the world works with life is that photosynthesis, in other words, the tree, accepts sunlight and uses that energy to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. And the oxygen goes up, and that's why we have an oxygen atmosphere, so we can breathe it. The hydrogen gets trapped in the leaf, or at least some of it does. And they also chew out carbon dioxide to get the carbon. So the world is kept alive by nature's way of splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. And, you know, what we have to do now is they say we have to use non-fossil energy sources, like wind, like geothermal if you want, like tides. As you know, I feel we have to use nuclear. I think it's maybe the safest of all. But non-carbon sources. And that has to be used not to make electricity, or I should say not just to make electricity, because we have to get those plants, those windmills, that sunlight, and that nuclear power plant to fly an airplane.
And that's my question. How are we going to get planes?
Well, the way you do it is you have them split water to make hydrogen, and you fly the airplane on hydrogen. And Maggie, the painful thing to me is we've done it.
We have, yeah.
How did we fly to the moon?
How do we get all those rockets out in space and
with
satellites
hydrogen,
out there?
Hydrogen and oxygen.
The car companies already know this.
You'd be surprised how ignorant people are. I mean, and my problem is that I think that this answer. There's a fundamental question. I can put it as simply as this. How do you get a nuclear power plant, the non-fossil energy from the nuclear power plant, to fly an airplane? Mm-hmm. And you make hydrogen, you fly the airplane, just like you made hydrogen and flew the rockets to the moon. Okay? And by the way, you should then fuel your car, right?
Well, it has fueled cars, but
there are hydrogen fuel cell cars all around. There are all these things all around. But it's so simple. I think people don't believe it. It's needed, so they.
It's not that it's so simple people don't believe it. It's what they're told to believe by people who stand to make money still using fossil fuel, I believe.
Yeah, but they could make an awful lot of money with this.
Well, and how do we turn their heads around? The ones that are causing the biggest problem by what they manufacture and how they manufacture it and giving us a society and culture we've come to rely on.
Well, let's take airplanes. I spoke about airplanes a little bit today. Airplanes, first of all, when they dump their CO2 out, which you sure can't sequester, right? It's at 33,000 to 36,000 feet. And that's where the CO2 lasts 300 to 400 years. It's the most dangerous place to dump CO2 in the planet.
Mm-hmm.
We can fly those airplanes on hydrogen. Okay, and the synergies from using hydrogen and the efficiencies from using hydrogen, the airplanes fly further, much, much further. They carry much higher payloads. There's all sorts of money to make. What's the barrier to that? Because mm-hmm. Lockheed have designed them, and Boeing have copied Lockheed, and the Germans have designed them as well. The barrier is the infrastructure of the airfields. There's no place to refuel it, so you can't build an airplane unless you know you can get it refueled. And one of the things I don't know if I got to saying it today is, what can we do with the big, I'll call it over-national organizations, like the G8 or the G20 or United Nations? We could easily say, you must have liquid hydrogen refueling facilities at all the major airports in the world. And if we did that, you wouldn't have to do anything else, because the airline manufacturers couldn't be left out. Those airplanes are so much better. They're so much more efficient. They carry higher payloads. Everyone would be building them as fast as possible.
Okay, well, I'm going to throw a why not at you that I've heard. We're killing so many, this is coming from people who lead our city, as a matter of fact. We'll be eliminating so many jobs. If we just jump to that conclusion, look at all the jobs that we are going to immediately erase. We're going to put people out of work. Well, now we've got thousands, if not tens of thousands, out of work. What's the excuse for that? They can't use that job threat anymore, because the job threat's already proved to be invalid. But this is what I hear. If you were to go to your solution and make infrastructure aim at that direction and solve the problem, first thing you're going to get from an uneducated politician is that trucking companies are out of business. He'll give you a list of local companies that will be out of business. This is what we're dealing
with. Well, I think that's nonsense. Whenever you have these changes, you get many more jobs, you know. Trucking companies won't be out of business. I think we should use rail more. You still have trucks. You have to move things around. They'll just be hydrogen fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And why would you lose jobs? You'll create jobs for those sorts of things. Hamilton, I started my engineering career after Queen's Steel Company of Canada. I find it appalling coming back here that those companies that really were the underpinning of Hamilton in those days are now all gone. Stelco's gone. DeFasco's gone. The point is that what creates jobs is new innovation-intensive jobs which have new technologies, and that will be a much better world. I think that the loss of jobs is nonsense. You lose jobs if you have an old system and you shut down the old system. You sure as hell don't lose jobs if you create new systems with new opportunities for bright people to move ahead.
This would be a perfect opportunity for some inventive person like yourself or somebody to come in and say, we don't have to make steel at U.S. Steel. We can make something else. It's a plant that we can use. We can retrofit it to make something else. And other people tell me, no, you can't. To retrofit that plant would cost too much. It needs too much work. That's why it was dumped. Like you're saying, to get around the knee-jerk reaction of thinking how to solve the problem. People use what tools they've been taught to use.
Sure, and it's natural human, and they used to be called Luddites. And if you go to rail and things like that, I mean, there were women who tore up rail tracks in Cleveland, South Dakota, because the gauge was different. And they had a lot of men's jobs unloading some rail cars to load another car so they could go on the railroad the rest of the way. But, you know, and Maggie, I wouldn't say that no one's going to lose a job, but as you point out, they've already lost them. And so what we have to do is create new jobs that are innovation-intensive, that are on the beginning of the wave, not on the end of a wave, for the next generation that's coming along. The GO train coming in here.
Exactly.
Okay? The GO train could easily be converted to hydrogen. First of all, with just the diesel engines, we can run diesel on hydrogen as well. And then you move in fuel cells, which would be cleaner, quieter, and all that sort of stuff.
It's interesting that you can run diesel on hydrogen. I didn't know that.
You have diesel engines have run on hydrogen. You don't need fuel cells. Fuel cells are better. It's just that right now, at their stage of the development, they're more expensive, and we need more development. See, all these technologies are still, as someone said, we build fuel cells with PhDs, putting them together by hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a fuel cell will ultimately be a much less expensive piece of equipment than an internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, not today.
Well, okay, so that can be the argument that it's a less expensive piece of equipment. And for a lot of corporations, the mantra for the economy is grow, 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 grow. They still don't get that you can't have an economy that's based constantly on growing because we've...
Well, that's another problem, and that's a tragedy. I think that quality of life can grow, but other things shouldn't grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say James Watt, when he walked upon the green on a Sabbath afternoon, dreaming of a steam engine, well, he put colossal people out of work. Because,
mm-hmm.
And who were they mainly? Many of them were slaves. I mean, the reasons we had slaves is we wanted people to do heavy physical, muscular work. One of the reasons that slavery is gone, it's not just Abraham Lincoln.
Not morality so much as...
Morality was in there. I don't want to dismiss that. But what allowed it? And what allowed it is that we didn't need slaves anymore for the grunt work.
That's the truth of it. It comes to greed. Yeah. But the truth of it is our economy, our culture, our whole social system is based on greed. And greed increases for a few while the masses are impoverished and we're facing this amazing wall of change where there's going to be thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who are just going to get left behind because they're depending on technology, as we've heard even at this engineering conference. Technology will solve it. Politicians will make the policies and correct it. People have to understand that that is not going to be the way to solve the problem. That is what's got us into the problem by greed, by not looking far enough ahead.
Well,
as
there was always greed. There was always greed. My problem with today's culture is that it's look at when there were kings and slaves,
mm-hmm.
it was really a divided society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not many people in Mozart's era could listen to Mozart's music, but there's a set of reasons for that. But the other thing that is very scary is that we know that middle class and lower class folks, their salaries have not kept up with things, and it's these wealthy, obscenely greedy people that are pulling on these stupid amounts of money for
mm-hmm.
being CEOs and board members, etc., and that's widened. Now, fortunately, this latest crisis has people that, you know, the way to be honored is not necessarily to be the wealthiest person in town, which used to be. I mean, that's quite...
That's a hard issue to get around. Andrea Horvath for the provincial NDPs announced that she wants to cap all salaries at 400,000. I think she could cap them at 100,000 and people would get along just fine. I'd like to see her go a step further and forcibly extract that funding so that it can go back into housing systems and health systems and poverty issues. And
yeah, I worry about the punitive things on top. I think there are other ways. That's a barrier.
Mm.
I prefer attractors. In other words, I prefer things that make life better.
Mm-hmm.
But corporate greed is not driven by politics, it's driven by boards of directors, all of whom come from the same class.
Mm-hmm. You know, power struggles.
Yeah. And anyway, I don't want to necessarily go that way, except to say that, yes, our society, I'm afraid, is splintering more between a very wealthy group and most of the rest of us.
The methods that have been foisted upon us to make the society that we've now lost, we don't have. We can't solve our problems currently because we don't have the tools, because the tools that we used to use are what got us into this situation. I find it a eureka moment. You were saying earlier, I mean, you stressed that it's happening anyway. We're not going down a path that's going to end in a good result for humanity for the next, which is probably quite true, but we can't say that to people. If we scare people into a mobilization, then nothing will change.
Well, you scare them, I'm afraid, on trivial things. I mean, you scare them on swine flu.
Yes.
You know, it's nutty what we get scared about. I think it's not a matter of scaring. It's a matter of responsibly saying what's happening and the fact that there's a long-shot chance, but there is a chance out, and it's called to use non-carbon energy, and I list them again. Wind, sunlight, for sure, right? Nuclear, hydraulic, which we're already using, those things, and nuclear has to be in there. We
and,
forget that
and
the sun
water.
Is a nuclear power plant. Well,
waves.
Water is what you harvest the hydrogen from. That's not an energy
well,
source.
Well, I was thinking waves, motion for
oh, yes,
turbines.
Oh, yeah, sure. But there's not a lot of that. If you want to get the large quantities of energy, you have to go to nuclear.
I don't really have a problem with nuclear, except for the fear-mongering that's already gone on.
Well, the fear-mongering, somehow we have to... No, people have to grow up. They have to, rather than just that their emotions trigger them, they have to look at the facts. And the facts are that it's by far the safest energy source that we've ever used.
Okay, so let's give them some tools to think about. Let's say to the listeners, it's time to realize where our society came from, what it was built upon. We've seen it fall apart. We've seen where the money's gone. We've seen the vast amounts of differences between the worker's salary and some CEO's salary. It's becoming exposed. We can't let fear or complacency let us step backwards and think technology will fix it, our government will fix it. We have to tell them, grow your own food. This is what I say to people. Cool your house or your apartment by growing a vertical wall of greens to cool your immediate environment. Take care of that immediate situation of surviving the heat and surviving hunger. But also when you say, here's a chance for technology to turn it a little bit, and we are being jerked around so much by greenwashing and by corporations who stand to lose a lot of money. That whole tar sands business is the biggest mistake. And it's so embarrassing. It's still happening because people want to make their money as fast as they can.
Well, it's not just the corporations. The people that live in Alberta want the money.
There you go.
You know? And what would you do with that? I'm not saying shut down the oil sands, as you know. I'm saying do it right. And I've told you in my book, it talks about using nuclear and hydraulic to make hydrogen, to add hydrogen.
Exactly.
So that you get much more oil out of the tar sands for the amount that you mine. What we're doing now is we're rejecting carbon as CO2. And so you get less product and more environmental damage, and you use up your resources faster.
And they're trying to sell carbon capture or carbon storage,
yeah,
which is a false lead.
They'll sell it, and they'll spend a lot of money on it, and then it will fail. To put that in context, there's a phrase which is useful: old technologies always fight back.
Yes, okay.
And that's what the fossil fuel industry is doing with CO2. And as I mentioned to you earlier, you know, you take coal out of the ground and its molecular weight is 12, say, or a little bit more than 12. Mm-hmm. You change that, you change the carbon to the CO2, the molecular weight is, 44,
yeah.
Right? So you've got more than three times as much stuff to bury, to sequester, as you took out of the ground, and you took it out, to the stuff you've captured as a gas. Now, come on, folks. Not going to work. And not only that, remember that all that additional equipment is a capital cost on top of the energy that you've harvested, and you'll need more energy to harvest it. So it isn't doing anything about getting more energy. You'll in fact get less energy, and you'll have all these capital costs. Now, if I may go to nuclear again, you can tell that I'm high on that. A nuclear power plant capital cost may be a little bit more than a coal-fired plant. Not much, but a little bit more. Now, if you add the capital cost of the carbon capture and sequestration on top of the coal-fired plant, it gets to be a much more expensive proposition than a nuclear plant. It just, nothing makes sense in it.
Proponents, I've heard, are making money off this carbon capping.
Of course.
It's, you know, they're selling
it. You, the taxpayer, are paying them.
Exactly. It's a moneymaker, and it's an excuse to allow bad industry to continue doing bad habits.
Yeah, but industry, established industry, always wants to.
Okay, and we've just said that. We could say that again, but we have to get the point.
There's nothing new about that. You know, on the Obama election night, I found it really interesting that here is America, I'll use their phrase, going into a wave of future, I hope. Many people have hope for Obama. And across the bottom of the screen was saying, clean coal for the future. I thought, talk about the most, you know, moronic thing to say.
Somebody needs to teach Obama. I'm sorry, President Obama, there's no such thing as clean coal. Let's move on.
Yeah, but he won't.
Why?
He's got a political... Well, there's two things. They've got what they believe to be a really good energy secretary because he's won a Nobel Prize. But remember, Nobel Prizes are acquired by... No, I'm not dismissing them. It's a great achievement. But they look at one issue very deeply. They're not systemic system thinkers. Okay, and so he will do the things that are narrow, okay, and he'll propose biomass, okay, and all these other things which are counterproductive. Do you know how biomass started in the United States? Maybe this is a story for me to end on, because then we've got to go to other things. You remember the Russians, we called it, invaded Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the Russians are in Afghanistan fighting them. No one has to think. They know that they're for the poor fellows that are fighting the the Russians, okay? The Russians also at the same time, by the way, were building schools for women and the like, okay? But we were against them. We means we, the West, largely led by the United States. So we sold Stinger missiles and that sort of thing so they could shoot down Russian helicopters, and that they were the freedom fighters. That was our name for them. They happen to be the same folks that are today's Taliban, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it have been more smart to at least support the Russians in trying to improve that culture rather than shoot them down and get them cleared out so we could move in later? That was also the year of the Olympics, as you and I will remember, and we decided to show the Russians how disappointed we were in them. We would not go to the Olympics, and we didn't. And that wasn't good enough, so we decided that, as the Americans decided, that they would not send them wheat, which they needed. Okay, and that's fine, except you get to the American farmer. Who are we going to sell our wheat to?
Exactly.
And that's when they dreamed up the idea of biofuels and making corn into ethanol and that kind of thing. So for a politician, it was really clever. You kept beating on the Russians, and you fed and you gave something to do for our farmers, and you made us quote-unquote energy independent. That was the start of the ethanol lobby. And then, of course, it gets taken over by Archer Daniel Midland and all the industries that provide fertilizers, etc., and so the legacy goes right back to Afghanistan and how it started in our heirs in Afghanistan. But right now it's not an energy policy. They cast it as an energy policy, but it's a farm lobby, and it's the big companies that are really pushing it.
It always is.
And it's a flaw. In other words, they either put out just as much greenhouse gas as gasolines. You know, it's just a mess. And then you drive the price of corn up, and so the price of hogs go up.
But there's so much to cover, and there's so many open and honest answers that need to be said. That, as you said in your talk, scientists have to be brave and stand up and be able to tell the truth without repercussions.
Most aren't.
Well, the only scientists that I've talked to at first, look at Stern, for example. I mean, it isn't until they retire and are out of the industry that they feel that they can come forward and say, just what you're saying, here's the truth about what's going on. Here's the truth about the IPCC. Here's the truth about all kinds of things that we've been force-fed. Television set is our worst enemy because it's just a tool for the corporate marketing of our brain so that we think we need to live this way. We need to have a car. We need to have this toy. We need to have a cell phone. We can't live without a computer. But if we're smart, we'll think about going back to an era, my grandparents' time.
Well, I would prefer, say, ahead, too, you know, because when you go ahead, the quality of life is simply better. You pick up the best of what your grandfather lived like, but not all of it, because not all of it was terrific. In other words, think of the these sort of things. So I think we should be selective about that.
But the Mennonites have been doing just the same thing.
Yes, I agree.
You know?
I agree.
But I know you have to get back to the conference, and I'm so glad you came, and we've had some time to talk outside of the lectures that are going on in there, and I just wish we had more time to talk.
Well, it would be a pleasure. Maybe if I come back through Hamilton again, we can get
definitely
together.
That was Dr. David Sanborn Scott in interview at McMaster University, spring of 2009. His book is called Smelling Land. You might have seen CTV's ads on television asking to help save local programming. This is not CTV's main programming. We're talking about local media and the loss of it. For more links and information, please go to www.oside.ca or the podcast link where I archive my shows at Radio Number 4 All, Radio for All. And that's it for this week. You have been listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3.
Redefining Radio.
Sync FM.